You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, who are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 167 by Dr. Steiner, entitled The Human Spirit, Past and Present, Occult Fraternities and the Mystery of Golgotha, 12 lectures translated by Matthew Barton. This is Lecture 8, given on the 2nd of May, 1916. We have been reflecting on matters connected with occult brotherhoods, as we have called them, and last time we attempted to shed some light on one of the most significant symbols that reappears time and again in such fraternities, the rediscovery of the lost word. This is a theme I could go on speaking about for years on end without ever exhausting it. Today I wish to add something to it, that in the world that knows little or nothing of spiritual science could not be seen to have any connection with these occult brotherhoods, even though it informs them, flows through them as teaching, as right, as world view. In other words, we will speak of something that has a kind of connection with other subjects we have discussed, but in a way we can only understand if at the end of our deliberations we enter into the whole spiritual, scientific aspect of the question we will be dealing with today. Here we must speak of a gloomy chapter in history, which specifically from the perspective we will explore today in connection with spiritual science, could also be entitled How Religions Sometimes Arise. You may remember from your school days that Henry VIII sat on the throne of England from 1509 to 1547. I imagine that you will remember him as someone of less than exemplary qualities. You will probably recall, first and foremost, that Henry VIII had six wives, two of whom he had executed, one because she no longer pleased him, and the other, really, for the same reason. He wanted to execute his last wife, too, the sixth, but this did not happen because she was a little more cunning than he was, and got round him in a very coquettish speech that took place between them. Now, as you may remember, he did not find it particularly easy to divorce his first wife, as their marriage had been performed in accordance with all ecclesiastical rules. And if all the outward customs and views of the world had been retained, Henry VIII's divorce would have had to be approved by Pope Clement VII. But the Pope found there was no reason to approve it, and continually refused the latter's petitions. These negotiations went to and fro for many years. The Pope refused to issue the divorce, a desperate situation. What does one do in such a case? Well, it cannot always be done, but if one is Henry VIII, one does it anyway. One establishes a new religion, founds a new church. Thus Henry VIII established the new church, which, after some modifications, now lives on as the Anglican Church in England, which today has 20 million adherents. Henry VIII founded a new church. When others do this, they develop a new teaching. But Henry VIII was not a clever man, as we can see from his conversation with his last wife, and he could not conceive of any new teaching as the basis for his church. So he retained the old doctrines and founded a new church. That is, he gradually persuaded the illustrious men of Parliament, of the state, to agree no longer to regard the Pope as the head of the English Church, but instead himself, Henry VIII. Through the famous Act of Supremacy that was passed at the time in England, Henry VIII, and thus also, of course, all his successors, were declared to be the head of the Church. and so now he could get his divorce. He had achieved his goal, had he not? But perhaps it is legitimate to consider such a thing in its connection with the ongoing events of human evolution. One of the men whose life was closely connected with the establishment of the new church by Henry VIII was the renowned figure Thomas More. As you no doubt know, he was the author of a book entitled Utopia, from which later utopian treatises took their name. You may remember a work in this vein by Bellamy. People believe that a great many such utopian works have been written. As we will see in a moment, though, this is simply hearsay. Whenever someone writes about an ideal state of some kind, which clever people do not believe can be realized in practice, which is often also true, they are regarded as utopian, after the country Utopia, which More describes in his work. In his Utopia, More described various institutions of his, let us first say, imaginary state. And one of them was that religious tolerance for different confessions should prevail. This would, therefore, be a state that declares religion to be a private matter. There is a redemptorist, a kind of Jesuit, who not so long ago wrote about Thomas More and questioned whether Thomas More can really have believed that religious tolerance should hold sway in an ideal state. He was not wrong to ask this. But we should not forget either that it would be difficult for a redemptorist to accept such a thing, for after all the Catholic Church beatified Thomas More, and this beatification was so greatly emphasized in the 1890s that one can see that the Catholic Church probably intends to make him a saint in the not-too-distant future. Yes, my dear friends, in such an instance, the Catholic Church is usually fully conversant with its historical records, for sanctification is a very laborious procedure, and one that draws fully on the files and records. Above all, the Advocatus Regius must accentuate everything that supports the belief that the person in question really was a holy man, and that miracles were accomplished by him. You can't be made a Catholic saint without performing miracles. This whole procedure takes a long time. Then the so-called Advocatus Diaboli must speak too, proposing everything that could be held against the person in question. Now, let us imagine, where sanctification of More is being considered, that the Church exposes itself to the danger of the Advocatus Diaboli objecting to his acknowledgment of religious tolerance. This would rule him out as a saint, wouldn't it? But there is really much else, too, that speaks against such a thing. And if we perused the biography of Thomas More in detail, in so far as it is known, we would find that there is a great deal that runs counter to the idea that More merely sought to preach religious tolerance through the vehicle of his work Utopia. And yet a prime trait of his may, after all, favor this view. Although a very pious man, Thomas More was, we can say, greatly favored by fortune. He rose through various state appointments, became a member of Parliament, and eventually Henry VIII's Lord Chancellor. For a saintly person, therefore, he achieved very high rank and status. Thomas More was, though, a pious man, as I said, and true to his conscience. And because of the special relationship he had with Henry VIII, he was required to give his verdict on the establishment of the new church. And, lo and behold, he did not endorse it, despite being not only a pious man, but also pliant by nature. Thomas More refused to give his verdict, as Lord Chancellor, that Henry VIII's actions were right. What does one do in such a situation, if one is Henry VIII? Does one try to refute More's cogent arguments? No, one locks him up. After some to-ing and fro-ing, Henry had More thrown in the Tower. And it now fell to the very illustrious Court of Lords to decide what verdict to issue in his case, one of the first great sins under the new church. My dear friends, it is not without interest to consider this verdict. More was led from the Tower to the illustrious court, and with the aid of the sheriff or state prosecutor, William Pinkston, was condemned to be taken back to the Tower, and from there to be led forth again and paraded to the city of London in a tumbril to Tyburn, and to be hanged there, but only until he was half dead. Then he was to be cut down and drawn and quartered. This meant that his body would be cut open while he was still alive, his innards taken out and burned, and his body, apart from the head, divided into four parts, and taken to the four ends of the city of London to be set up on spikes. As a terrible warning to the populace, his head was to be planted on a high spike on London Bridge. The illustrious lords issued this verdict. In fact, it was not carried out. The sentence was mercifully transmuted to mere beheading in the Tower, and the rest of it was not done, except for his head on a spike on London Bridge. These are the historical facts concerning the end of Thomas More. And all this took place in the first half of the 16th century, really not such a very long time ago. And so we find it unlikely that Thomas More really propounded religious tolerance, doing so only in faithfulness to the Catholic Church and by way of resistance to Henry VIII, and in consequence being beatified as a martyr. It is clear, therefore, that Thomas More was not a rationalist of the Enlightenment type in the 18th century, not a free spirit who preached religious tolerance. But now, let us look a little more closely at his work, Utopia. This is, however, an elaborate and lengthy book, and I can only consider a couple of aspects relating to it. Utopia contains ideas about an imaginary state, which, we are told, was established on the faraway island of this name. The chief characteristics of this state would doubtless appear very instinctively desirable to a great many people. And yet there is much to show that merely dry, sober reason holds sway in this state. More describes, for instance, that all the houses are built on square foundations and are all identical, and that the streets, too, run in symmetrical arrangements. We are told that there are strict, one could say police-enforced injunctions, stating how many youths and men and maidens and women may live in each house. If there are more than the prescribed number, some must leave and go to houses where there are fewer. Thus it is regarded as important that, quote, human material, close quote, is distributed evenly between the various houses. No one may acquire private property, but the economy is run on roughly communist lines. To avoid undue value being placed on private ownership in the form of gold, strict jurisdiction assures that each person can only earn a certain level of income, and everything over and above this is ceded to the state. In particular, no individual can acquire gold, all of which belongs to the state. But to avoid the idea that gold is especially desirable, any potential superfluity of it must be made into chains used to bind criminals, or otherwise it is distributed in the form of vessels used for menial purposes and such like. Thus gold must always be used in a way that counters any possible idea that it is of special value. Police powers are not completely unbounded in the state of Utopia. Thus it is expressly stated that there is no prescription regarding the number of children who may live in a house. House comrades take meals together, and there are strict regulations about where the elders or youths should sit, who should serve, and so forth. This state is a fantasy rather than a future ideal. Its rational measures have, it is said, liberated the inhabitants to so great an extent from passions and desires that eating is not regarded as something done to please the palate, which would run counter to higher human development. Instead, people are grateful for the blessing of enjoyment that accompanies the necessary consumption of food. You discern the subtle distinction, I am sure. And in particular, the inhabitants of Utopia say that one should be grateful that hunger, which can be called an illness, since starving is as bad as falling ill, does not need to be cured by poisons and bitter remedies like other diseases, for otherwise one would have to consume them every day, and this would be unpleasant. It is also expressly ordained that at table, before eating, one should always read out or listen to a moral sermon given by one of the illustrious minds in Utopia, which in every other way also lead and guide the populace, and are at the same time priests. There is also a discourse on the principles of worship in Utopia, how one can rightly serve God, even if it might please him to be worshipped in different ways by different kinds of human beings. And this is one of the reasons, perhaps the chief one, for Utopus, the founder of Utopia's state institutions, allowing full religious freedom. This religious freedom is really very reasonable, for it allows each person to express what he regards as his personal religious persuasion. However, the basic assumption here is that there is and can be no one in Utopia who would deny the existence of God, the immortality of the soul, and judgment of the soul after death. These, writes Moore, are common principles of all religions, and everyone will acknowledge this. As the rational counterpart of this religious freedom, no one can insult, let alone harm another person, because of his religious views. To sum up, if one engages with the content of this book Utopia by Thomas More, one finds it is founded on some curious outlooks that one can only regard as in every way rational. And wherever More inserts such things as I have mentioned, such as praise of the blessing of food being tasty or similar, this is based on very specific assumptions that refute any suggestion that this was all ironic, that Moore was saying the whole state was nonsense. What he sought to say, in fact, was that human beings are by no means always disposed to interpret rational teachings in a rational way, but instead distort them and make a caricature of them. There are, in fact, other societies, not in Utopia, but elsewhere, in which, for instance, equal entitlement, equal acknowledgement of different religious communities holds sway, and in which people make efforts to realize rational doctrines, but where, nevertheless, not every individual always behaves rationally when he recounts the views and outlooks he has drawn from a rational realm. I will refrain from naming the, quote, far-off, close quote, places where such a thing occurs. From a certain point of view, therefore, we should take Thomas More and his island of Utopia very seriously. We ought not to forget, either, that Thomas More was not only very pious from childhood on, but also someone who tirelessly practiced his meditations and spiritual exercises. In the profoundest sense, he took this practice seriously, spending hours every day conducting his soul into worlds of spirit by means of meditation. On the last day of his life, before being executed, More sent to his daughter from the tower the secret matters of his spiritual practice, so that those who came for him would not find them in his cell. He continued his meditations until the very moment he was executed. This man, who took the development of his soul so seriously, repeatedly expressed the fact that in accordance with the conditions of his day, This is a time, of course, when Protestantism was starting to spread. He sought nothing other than to be a true son of his church, the Roman Catholic Church, that is. And for the sake of this church, he allowed himself to be executed. There are various other aspects of the book Utopia that we should also consider. Primarily this: upon this distant island, said to be far removed from any geographical connection with Europe, ancient wise men landed only on a single occasion, wise Romans and Egyptians, who instructed Eutropius to found the state in the way he did. Then we hear further curious things, contained at least in older editions of Thomas More's work. We are introduced to a certain alphabet consisting of right angles and their combination, which is supposedly used in the Utopian script. If you look at the customary books today that reproduce the script of some Masonic orders, you cannot help seeing a strong resemblance between this, as used in some Masonic contexts, and the script More says is that of Utopia. More also gives certain phrases and sayings that supposedly govern modes of conduct in Utopia, and these combine Latin, Greek, and Hebrew texts in a rather remarkable, albeit very veiled way, which is reminiscent of certain formula used in occult brotherhoods. Then another curious thing is said. It is expressly stated that Roman and Egyptian wise men landed on the island, but nothing of Christianity arrived there. Everything becomes more and more mysterious. Remember, Thomas More was a pious Catholic, someone devoted to his spiritual practices, but he wrote a book, Utopia, describing an island with institutions which he undoubtedly meant seriously, not ironically at all, but in which Christianity does not figure. What is one to make of this man? How can we understand him? Well, we need only recall the fact that he undertook a spiritual practice. If we give proper consideration to various things he said, which are connected with his spiritual exercises, we will find that Thomas More really did get somewhere with them. But now remember also the era in which More lived. Recall the fact that this period in England was dominated by the king, Henry VIII, in the 16th century, and thus shortly after the transition from the 4th to the 5th post-Atlantean age. Not long ago I described this period of transition to you when I spoke of Pico della Mirandola, Savonarola, and so forth, trying to show how this era comes to expression in certain individuals. But in Thomas More, too, we have someone at the beginning of the 5th post-Atlantean era, a time whose most intrinsic aspect was the fading of ancient occult capacities. These faded in the general populace, but were still available for those who engaged in spiritual exercises, such as those practiced by Thomas More. Now, a certain thing can happen. Through spiritual exercises, as is really always the endeavor of a proper practice, we can at the same time come to see the connection between our ordinary human conception of daily life and what rises from the depths of the soul as vision of a higher spiritual world. But something else can happen as well, and this is what occurred in the case of Thomas More. Through the practice of his spiritual exercises, More was transposed in sleep into the astral world, and was there able to have quite different experiences from an ordinary person who does not undertake such spiritual exercises in the astral world. And yet he could not bring these experiences back with him in a directly conscious way. He was able to experience a great many things in the world of spirit, and though he could not bring them back into consciousness, he did bring them back with him. And what he brought back in this way he described in his book Utopia. This book is only mere fantasy, forgive me, for very clever people. For someone conversant with reality, it embodies a spiritual experience in which the connection between the latter and ordinary thinking has not come to full consciousness. But such spiritual experiences are all the more compelling in consequence. One can be a good, pious Catholic, and even be so pious that one is later beatified and made a saint, is martyred in the Catholic cause, and yet can still write down the spiritual experiences one has had on the astral plane, for one has experienced them, and such experience exerts an elemental power. It has struck me that translators of the book have often also tried to translate the name of the island of Utopia. In German, the name Nirgendheim has been imposed on it, or in other words, quote, the island that does not exist, close quote. Clearly, those who do such a thing have understood nothing of the whole business. You have to grasp what is at work here to properly translate the name Utopia. You see, if you actually enter the astral world, the laws of ordinary three-dimensional space, as these obtain here, no longer apply to astral experience. These laws, of which we learn in geometry, really only hold good for the outer sensory world, and we cannot speak of what we experience in the astral world in the same way. We can use spatial designations metaphorically in this case, but must at the same time know that such pictures have a different meaning. It is impossible to speak of experiences in the astral world in the same way as we speak of things and beings in the world of the senses. It would be completely meaningless to speak of the astral world as one does of things and entities in the sensory world, that a lady sits here and another over there, say. Such thinking cannot be applied directly to the astral realm. But there, instead, we become aware of being in a non-localized world, where we are compelled to negate the spatial localization of the sensory physical world. And therefore, we should translate the name Utopia as non-locality. It is this that conveys the quality of the world into which Thomas More gazed. What, especially, did he encounter in this world? It is scarcely surprising that he met here something that resembles the principles and customs that hold sway in occult societies. As we said, these customs of occult brotherhoods originate in ancient wisdom, deriving also from ancient observations of this astral world. This vision faded and then lived on in various fraternities as tradition, preserved by people who knew of such things as history related them, and as they were passed on pictorially, and if you like, by dictation, but who themselves had no direct insight into them anymore. But when people, such as Thomas More, undertook spiritual exercises, they were able to pass into the world of spirit, and something similar came toward them there, which they then described. It is scarcely surprising, therefore, that what lived in many occult brotherhoods as a doctrine, as yet untouched by Christianity, was also described by Thomas More. He conveys this as something that informs the state institutions on the island of Utopia, originating in ancient Egyptian and Roman, but not yet Christian sources. We are here in the domain of occult societies that see their lofty importance precisely in the fact that they originated as Egyptian orders, and still further back. And now let us connect what has been said here with our knowledge of the deepest nerve of the Christian worldview. I have often spoken of this. Christianity is, of course, founded on the fact that a spiritual potency we call by the name of Christ descended to indwell the body of Jesus, spiritualizing it entirely in the 30th year of his life. Jesus had gradually acquired the capacity for this to happen by passing through the souls of the two Jesus boys. what actually occurred. A spiritual power that was not interwoven with earthly evolution until the mystery of Golgotha, from then on, united with this evolution. First, dwelling in the body of Jesus of Nazareth, and then passing into earth evolution through the mystery of Golgotha, uniting ever more profoundly and completely with it as our evolution continues. We have often spoken of this. From spiritual heights where it once resided, this power descended to the physical earthly plane. Thus, whenever a wise and truly clairvoyant initiate of ancient times, this too I have mentioned in the past, raised himself into spiritual heights, in the era before the mystery of Golgotha, he naturally encountered the Christ there. At this time, those able to speak of the Christ therefore became prophets, who foretold his coming. For they found him there in worlds of spirit, and saw him, in a sense, on his way toward the earth, descending as sun spirit, so as gradually to become the spirit of the earth. Thus they could look ahead to a future moment in earth's evolution when what they saw only in lofty spiritual heights would unite with the earth. No sign of the Christ was to be found on earth before the mystery of Golgotha, however far one searched, however deeply one plumbed all that might be known of it. For this reason, of course, ancient earth knowledge amongst peoples and cultures, before the time of the mystery of Golgotha, did not possess Christ. But when the initiates of these mysteries had attained to a certain level, Christ's coming to earth was made known to them. Think how different everything is now, since the mystery of Golgotha, the very opposite of circumstances before it. Since the mystery of Golgotha, if we inquire into earthly evolution, we find Christ interwoven with the whole history of the peoples imbued with Christianity. To give an account of history without reference to this is really nonsensical. Even the historian Ranke felt this, asking himself at a great old age whether history has any meaning at all if one does not trace the Christ impulse through all its diverse phenomena. But in the worlds into which one can ascend, from which Christ descended to unite with earthly evolution, Christ is no longer so directly present. From those heights, one must then look down again upon the earth to see how he united with it. You see, what I have said is a reality that underlies the terrible fear that some religious confessions have of occultism. Naturally, they understand nothing of true occultism, nor of how the Christ can be found through true spiritual science. However, they do sometimes make the acquaintance of that shallow form of occultism that states Christ is only on earth, and that one must strip away this Christ when one rises into elevated spiritual heights, since he is not to be found there. This is the fear that certain orders of priests have, that through an occultism they know only in this shallow form, people could gain access to this secret. It has deeper Christian aspects than they are aware of, if one knows the facts, but can endanger Christianity if one knows only of a shallower occultism. This is why the Church is so much in conflict with occultism, a reality on which its antagonism is founded. Thus we really must hold on to what can be learned of Christ within our earthly existence. I have so often spoken of this. When we cross the threshold and rise into worlds of spirit, we must not forget what can be learned about Christ by occult means when we are still on earth. That is a deeper spiritual science compared to a shallow form that tells people either that Christ is only present to earthly vision or embodies himself in Alcyon and such like. Now, let us put ourselves in the shoes of Thomas More, who undertook exercises that enabled him to gain full clarity about Christ. When, subsequently, the world was in danger of suffering confusion in relation to Christ, then the Jesuits, albeit through still greater colossal confusion and error, tried to prevent this with their Jesuit exercises. Thomas More did not practice these kinds of Jesuit exercises, but ones instead that really did enable him to experience the whole reality of Christ Jesus. If he had entered the world of spirit in full consciousness, naturally he would have perceived Christ there and have seen how he had descended to the earth. But he was unable to establish a complete conscious context of understanding, and this resulted in him writing down half unconsciously what he had experienced in the spiritual world, where Christ, however, was not present. He expressed this by saying that Christianity had not yet arrived on the island of Utopia. And now we can also understand why Utopia contained something that would contradict all Thomas More's honesty, authenticity, and love of truth if he had composed it in full consciousness. I mean from the perspective of ordinary consciousness. He could never have written about the institutions of religious tolerance. But he did write down something whose whole foundation did not fully enter his conscious awareness. Religious tolerance was implicit in all that he perceived in Utopia, in the sense that the particular form of worship and ritual is of no account. To a very great degree, Thomas More was compelled to recognize two souls living in his breast, one here in the physical world, and the other living during sleep, which experiences a quite different world into which it cannot carry the Christ impulse. If we seek the basic tenor of feeling at work in a man such as Thomas More, inspiring him to write a work such as Utopia, we find the following. Occult perceptions and insights that are not fully experienced, laborious inroads into the world of spirit as Thomas More doubtless engaged in, are accompanied by anxieties which the soul does not experience as such. Instead, what is really a sense of fear remains more or less hidden in the subconscious. Then one seeks other reasons for one's experiences and actions. A masked anxiety that in conscious awareness is transformed into something quite different. The fear that Thomas More had was transformed into something quite different. As occult experiences churned in his sensibility, this gave rise to fear in him. And what would this fear have become if it had risen consciously into his soul? What would Thomas More have told himself? Let us assume for a moment, as hypothesis, something that cannot have happened, that into Thomas More's full consciousness had entered the thought that he saw something, which he later described in Utopia, in the astral elemental world and wished to describe it. He wished to describe it. Why? If he had fully understood the fear in him and, through writing, had perhaps succeeded in dispelling it, the following thoughts would have occurred to him. In the present world, era, one must, with every fiber of one's soul, do everything to fully perceive the Christ impulse and sustain it for and within humanity's evolution. But if people could somehow return to an ancient clairvoyance, they would see something that appears as his Utopia and contains nothing of the Christ impulse. Oh, guard yourself, this fear would have told him, from anything that can divert you from the path of the Christ impulse. This is what he would have told himself, and what he would have written if he had truly been able to feel his fear. But he did not fully experience it. It remained in his subconscious, and therefore he wrote down what he did as he saw it inwardly, and simply left the world with the riddle of this apparent irreconcilable contradiction between what he saw and his whole nature as a conscientious, candid person devoted to the truth. But having considered this, let us put ourselves in the position of the members of certain occult brotherhoods. Thomas More wrote Utopia. He is already held in suspicion, but this in itself would not have induced the illustrious lords to reach the verdict they did in his case. But remember that he is already regarded with suspicion for having acted against Henry VIII's intentions, and that the lords were also under some compulsion. Now let us assume that the majority of those sitting in the court of lords belonged to occult brotherhoods. What could and must they tell themselves? And what, from their perspective, was even fully required by their conscience? This man, Thomas More, had written the book Utopia, and this they saw as a betrayal of the secrets they were obliged to preserve. A complete betrayal. In his book stand many hints of all kinds about these secrets. Not only is the book a betrayal of them, but it shows how these things work on in the outward culture of mankind. It would have been clear to these people that if he had been initiated into an occult fraternity and had attained a particular degree within it, he would have had to swear that he would not betray its secrets. But this is what Thomas More had done. The wording of one of the oaths customarily sworn at the time in these societies is almost identical in its formulation to the verdict passed on Thomas More in London. Anyone who attached a certain degree within an occult fraternity in those times would have had to swear an oath that was very close indeed to the words of the court in London when the lords sentenced More. He was thus regarded as having betrayed in his Utopia the secrets of an occult brotherhood. You see, my dear friends, that to understand history it really is not sufficient to draw only on the accepted fable that people nowadays think of as history. Instead, we need to delve deeper into humanity's development and try to see what plays into human souls. Something like the death of Thomas More stands before us as a great emblem, a cipher we must decode in order to understand what is at work in history. It can only be deciphered if we come to see how supersensible impulses play into historical realities. And this can only be done through spiritual science. There are many, many moments in history that require this insight. A great deal presented to us as the fable convenue of history can only be fathomed when we know a little of what was playing into the souls of those involved in the events in question. And the great demands that our current age is making of us include this: that we shed a customary thoughtlessness about certain things. You see, ultimately, no one can objectively assess the value of something like the Anglican Church without knowing what saint has founded it, without knowing that there lived in the mind of the man who established it the capacity to execute two of his wives and to attempt this with a third. Clearly, such actions are a prelude to saintliness. When we reflect on such things properly and place them in the right light, what can also teach us a thing or two about conditions we are now living in, we will be compelled to acknowledge other more hidden and secret aspects connected with them. The important, hugely revealing fact connected with the composition of Thomas More's Utopia and with his whole life is interwoven, you see, with historical events at the time. Now, my dear friends, we might also wonder what would happen if some indiscreet person were to pass on what has been said here today to a Jesuit, and what an advocatus diaboli might then say about it at some later canonization of Thomas More. He might, perhaps, raise grave charges against More, but his opponent, the good advocatus, could reply that everything occult is the work of the devil, and if it could be known that Thomas More drew his utopia from occult depths, he might be said to be all the saintlier for having miraculously resisted the diabolical attacks contained therein. But what I wish to say is this. The fundamental theme, the leitmotif, if you like, of the lectures given here, is that spiritual realities and spiritual matters play into outer historical events, and that the nature of our fateful times, of present, gravely, incisive events, asks us to understand this. Next time, I will speak further of this. The end of Lecture 8.